Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. John Lash again, the navigator of the GNE, also known as the Main Turton. I'm recording on the 27th of January, a Sunday morning, a direct follow-up of the previous briefing, number 41, entitled Naming the Trickster. This is NAB Briefing 42, entitled Game Over for Pretenders. The specific purpose of this briefing is to elucidate for you a challenge. This is the challenge that the Narwhal now poses to the world at large. And in this briefing, in the course of this briefing, you can make it very clear to yourself what side of my challenge you stand on. You can stand with me, the person who gives the challenge, the one who delivers the challenge, or you can stand in the ranks of those to whom I make this challenge. Either way. Now, if you're a member of the GNE or a practitioner of planetary tantra, then you already stand with me in the sense that you follow the terma of Gaia Awakening. I am not the guru. The terma is the guru. The terma is a transpersonal message presenting the instructions of the intelligence of the earth to humanity. It's a transpersonal message. It stands by itself. I'm not presenting an oppositional proposition here as to say, you're either with me, John Lash, what a big deal he is, or you're against me. No. I'm presenting a challenge that stands before the entire human race in January of 2013. I'm defining that challenge. And I'm just saying, there's the challenge, and here's where I'm standing relative to it. Where are you standing? Choose where you want to stand. I'm only describing where I'm standing for the purposes of description, not for the purposes of inscription or recruitment. So, the challenge is to enter the Mephisto game. The game is underway. And in the course of this briefing, I will explain exactly what this game is. And more specifically, what is the entering move? That is to say, how you enter the game or not. You enter the game by the way you respond to the challenge of Mephisto. So here goes. To start off this briefing, I want to read some passages from a book entitled The Trickster in West Africa, A Study of Mythic Irony and Sacred Delight. And the author of this book is Robert D. Pelton. And it's worth mentioning that Robert D. Pelton is a Roman Catholic priest who was a student of Merce Eleade in the History of Religion Department at the University of Chicago Divinity School. And he is now Director General of Priests of Madonna House Apostolate. Okay, so here's John Lash reading some quotations from a book written by a Catholic priest. Let me point out something about Catholics and Christians. They are subject to a lot of delusions and errors about the workings of their own minds. But the primary delusion and error you find with these people is that they don't see that their Christian Catholic salvationist faith is the other side of Satanism. That Satanism, which they would expose and oppose, the workings of the devil in the world, the diabolical plan of the dark powers against Jesus the Redeemer, and so forth and so on, however you want to paint it, they are completely unable to see that that scenario of the diabolical attack upon humanity is just the other side of the coin of their salvation program. They can't see their own program. But because the Christian program of salvation through the Redeemer is just the flip side of the diabolical scheme of Satan, those in the Christian and Catholic belief system would be very intimate in a certain sense with the powers of Satan. And so what you'll find, for instance, on the internet, is that some of the investigators who are doing the best job so far, doing a pretty good job so far, of exposing the so-called satanic and diabolical elements in the current game of history are Christians. Why are they able to identify these things? Because they're actually identifying the elements in their own game. But due to the psychological mechanism of projection, they see these elements as alienated from their own psychic disposition. Actually, they are just talking about what's in their own mind. You know, if you read Jeffrey Burton Russell, who wrote several books on the devil and Lucifer and the Prince of Darkness and so forth, Jeffrey Burton Russell, who is an expert on the matter, although he's quite weak on actually the ethics and dynamics of Satanism, is one scholar who will tell you point blank what all other scholars agree upon, that Satan, as we know it, the horned, goat-like figure with bat wings, was a creation of the early Christian church. Satan is a creation of the Christian belief system. Therefore, it makes sense that devotees of the Christian belief system would be able to tell us things about Satan which are quite accurate. How do they know how Satan operates? Because they invented Satan in the first place. Although they are, of course, in complete denial of that fact. Nevertheless, because Satan springs from the same mentality and credo as the divine superhuman Redeemer, Christ, those who embrace Christ also are intimate with the powers of Satan. And of course, you can carry that observation all the way to the Vatican Bank, which currently is collapsing for reasons which would be fascinating to know. I might just take a moment to add this little footnote here. This footnote is timed to January, February of 2013, as the Italian edition of Not in His Image is due to appear in February 2013. The news has come out recently that people who visit the Vatican City, can no longer pay for their things they buy there, for the tourist gadgets, nor can they pay for their drinks and lunch at the Vatican bar with anything but cash. And so the heartbreaking news came out of Italy last week that the Vatican is losing 40,000 euros a day. Oh, how sad this is. Because the people who come and visit the Vatican and put out money, as I say, for doodads and mementos, can't pay with their credit cards. They can only pay for cash. Now, why is it that the Vatican City, people in charge of the Vatican City and the Vatican Bank, have decided only to deal in cash? Well, that's because they've lost their credit, i.e., they've lost their credibility. Catholic Church is losing its credibility so fast that it's also losing its credit. It's not because the Vatican doesn't want to extend credit through the credit card mechanisms. It's because it's losing its internal credit, that the credit card mechanisms have been rejected. And so now Satan, as enthroned and operating from the stronghold of Vatican City, has announced that he doesn't deal with credit cards anymore. All transactions with Satan, including selling your soul to him, must be conducted in cash. Just thought I'd let you know about that. I think it's an extremely good omen for the imminent appearance of Not in His Image in Italy. Now, to return to this book on the trickster by the Roman Catholic priest, Robert D. Pelton, I want to say that I dare to cite him because it's perfectly natural to do so in the course of my investigations as an occultist, as someone who investigates the occult or esoteric side of human affairs. A genuine occultist such as myself, if I may be so presumptuous as to use the word genuine, is like a detective who relies on informants. So if I'm a detective in the vice squad investigating a drug ring, I need to rely on informants who are actually in the criminal world that I'm investigating. So the informant might be a street dealer, or it might be someone much, much higher up on the hierarchy of drug dealing. You know, the recent film that was very successful by Martin Scorsese, The Departed. In that film, Jack Nicholson, who was a high-level mafioso-type drug dealer and gangster, proved to be a federal informant. And so I also rely on informants. And as far as I'm concerned, Robert D. Pelton is an informant in the criminally insane world of Roman Catholicism. And if he's a good informant, that means that the information he provides me with is good. And he should know, because he's in that criminal world. He's a part of it. Offhand, I can't think of any books on the trickster to recommend to you. Jung's writings are difficult, and he dealt with the trickster, but Jung tends to be muddled in his own thinking, and to, at the end of the day, to produce more confusion than clarity in the way that he treats the so-called archetypes of the collective unconscious. But there are some brilliant passages written brilliantly in Pelton's book. Here, for instance, is a passage from the opening pages. In symbolizing the transforming power of the imagination as it pokes at, plays with, delights in, and shatters what seems to be until it becomes what is, the trickster discloses how the human mind and heart are themselves epiphanies of a calmly transcendent sacredness, so boldly engaged with this world that it encompasses both nobility and messiness, feces, lies, and even death, end quote. Give you some idea of the subtlety and elaborateness of Pelton's language. He points out that, and this is basic intel, you should all have this intel, that the term trickster was introduced by a comparative mythologist called Daniel Brinton, and it appears to have been first used in Brinton's study of the baffling figures of North American Indian mythology and folklore, who are represented as deceivers or pranksters, and their names are legion. You have, of course, Coyote being primary in that legion of tricksters. Coyote is a trickster figure. So credit the introduction of the term trickster to Daniel Brinton. And it was then picked up by anthropologist Franz Boas, who described it as a prankster who combines in one personage no less than two or three and sometimes more seemingly different and contrary roles. A really, really striking observation or striking piece of intel that comes from my informant here occurs on page 8 of this book. And I was stunned when I read this, and you'll find that you may be as well. Pelton writes, quote, Brinton sought the cause of this degeneration in a confusion and a trivialization of language. He's talking here about the degenerative, the bizarrely comic and perverted degenerative behavior of pranksters or tricksters. And then he says, another scholar, Raffaele Petazzoni, in his valiant effort to trace the historical development of religious phenomenon,
has seen the trickster as a degraded, folkloricized master of the animals, end quote. Now let me translate this for you folks. What Pelton is saying is that the parameters established by other scholars lead to a primary indication about the character of the trickster, that it is, in a way, a deformed or degraded version of the so-called master of the animals. Well, doesn't that ring a bell for those of you who follow the Mahavidyas and Diamond Sky Dakinis in Planetary Tantra? You may recall that in writing about Matangi, the Mahavidya connected with the constellation of the Manitu, I said that Matangi can be considered to be the mistress of the animal powers. The master of the animals is a term for the Manitu, or spirit of the wilderness. In the ancient initiatory rites of passage of the American Indians, the neophyte who went on a vision quest had the hope and the aspiration to meet the Manitu, the spirit of the wilderness, who would usually appear in the form of a power animal. I have stated that in the magical system of Planetary Tantra, all the powers of the Manitu and all the animal powers of the Mother Goddess are summarized in Matangi and directed by Matangi. This is the supreme role of Matangi. And so isn't it amazing that Matangi, who summarizes that power, is also the teacher who presents the trick to defeat the trickster. The archetype could not be more clear. In order for there to be a power to defeat the archetype of the trickster, there must be a superior archetype, and that is Matangi. Matangi is she who vanquishes deceit. Matangi is she who teaches the trick to defeat the trickster. And how brilliantly this is indicated here by the suggestion from an Italian scholar that the identity of the trickster is rooted in the master of the animals. Quoting another passage, Pelton says, "The trickster symbolizes not only the mythology of human life, but the myth-making process of the human mind itself," end quote. Well, how about that? You see, my informants are reliable. Finally, I would skip to the last chapter of his book, which is entitled Toward a Theory of the Trickster. Of course, we're not just going to a theory of the trickster, folks. We're going to go to the encounter with the trickster. And though I cannot guarantee that any of you will actually meet that tulpa, the actual appearance of that material archetype, I can't guarantee that will happen. But I can assure you that you are now entering with me a path of visionary detection, a practice of visionary detection that leads directly to the detection of the tactics and strategies of the adversary to humanity and to the goddess herself. And knowing the tactics and methods of the adversary is as good as meeting the adversary. At the beginning of his final chapter, Toward a Theory of the Trickster, Pelton supplies a couple of lovely quotes, and I'll read them to you. The first one is from Saul Bellow's book, Mr. Samler's Planet. Quote, "And what is common about the common life? What if some genius were to do with the common life what Einstein did with matter, finding its energetics, uncovering its radiance?" End quote. The other quote is from Baudelaire. Genius is nothing more or less than childhood recovered at will, a childhood now equipped for self-expression. End quote. Beautiful indications and clues in those two quotes regarding our adventure in encountering the trickster. I'm sure you can draw your own conclusions. So in these concluding remarks, which go on for 60 pages, Pelton refers to the trickster's agility and to its use of verbal trickery, to its multivalence, its ability to assume various roles. And at one point, talking about African tricksters, he uses the example. This is a book about the trickster in West Africa, of course. So he cites the examples from various African tribes of the behavior of their tricksters, the Ashanti and other tribes of that region. And he says, the trickster transforms by no plan except the shape of his own urge to realize the act of dealing. Yet because this drive necessarily creates intercourse, he establishes the social geography of the world in the very process of playing out his own inner design. End quote. That is an absolutely brilliant passage. For one thing, when he says, the trickster transforms by no plan except the shape of his own urge to realize the act of dealing, that reminds me of the warning of the Gnostics regarding the Archons. In the second treatise of the great Seth, you find that remarkable line, the affirmation of the Telestai, that the Archons have no plan. Their plan is deceit for its own sake. Their plan is senseless. They have no ultimate agenda. They have no ultimate objective, although they would love you to convince you that they do. The ultimate objective, whatever it is, that comes from the trickster and the Archons, is a false objective. But you can be tricked into actually inventing that falsity in your own mind and fulfilling it for them. That is the power of the trickster. I like the way that Pelton says here, trickster has no plan except the shape of his own urge to realize the act of dealing. Well, exactly so. The plan of the trickster is to negotiate with you and to do it in such a way that you lose your reality and your sense of reality in the game, in the negotiations. The ultimate success of the trickster is to lure you into the trickster's game, the Mephisto game. And what we used to call that game back in the 60s was indicated by the elegant and eloquent term, mindfuck. The game of Mephisto is a mindfuck, which really has no objective, although various objectives can be attached to it. Finally, I would just add, without reading any further quotes, that Pelton repeatedly makes an observation that is supported by all other scholars of folklore and anthropology who have studied the trickster, and that is the comic element. The comic element. You know, I remember once I was watching an Alex Jones show a year or so ago, and at a certain moment, Jones just sort of shrugged his shoulders in exhaustion from his ranting and just shook his head and said, it's just all a big perverse joke. And that is absolutely so true. It is all a big joke. And he is part of that joke. He's not the solution. He's just another punchline in the ongoing joke of Mephisto. So there is, bear in mind, a comic element. It is really funny. It is funny and yet it is not funny at the same time. The cruel, murderous, and deceitful acts toward which human animals can be driven by the dealings of the trickster are not funny, and I wouldn't want to be subjected to any of them, and I wish that you not be as well. They're not funny, but there is something funny and comical in the way that the trickster operates. And I assure you that as we proceed now into the Mephisto game, you will find that there are some good laughs along the way. And when you can laugh and really know what you're laughing at, when you can have an insight about the workings of evil that makes you laugh, then you know that that insight is correct, that it is voracious, and that you are really getting through the trickster's game. Curiously, getting through the trickster's game brings the human animal back to laughter. It brings us back to our ludic capacity, what I have called perinoia, P-E-R-I-N-O-I-A. You will recall that perinoia is one of the seven elements in the calibration of the anthropos. And I advise you, I warn you, to bear in mind that Thelete and Sophia dosed us with an enormous power of perinoia, the mystico-ludic capacity. They did so that they could observe how the human animal would play with its environment and play with each other. We are gifted with this enormous capacity to play, but it has been hijacked in the dirty dealings of Mephisto. Cutting through Mephisto's magic, we get back to the real essence of that capacity for play. And if you want to read an interesting book about that, go read Homo Ludens by the Dutch scholar Huizinga, H-U-I-Z-I-N-G-A, Homo Ludens. That is a pretty good study, actually, on the background of the trickster. So, the title of this briefing is Game Over for Pretenders. Game over, of course, is a term from the world of electronic games and computer simulation consoles. Typically, when you play one of these games, you are presented with a situation which may be war, it may be some mysterious land occupied by a sorcerer. You are presented with a test. The game presents a test, and there are different levels of the test. And you are required to defeat a demon or defeat some guardian of the threshold or some archontic light gatekeeper in order to move through these levels. And if you fail at any particular level, the game is over. So the famous sign, game over. Now in the Mephisto game, you can fail at the entering move. In other words, you can fail even to get into the game. I want to say that in the most intimate instructions I have received from my guardian, Kali, she informed me that all events in human reality, in all situations, can be mastered by putting them into a gaming metaphor. Have I said this before? Probably have. It sounds deceptively simple. In fact, it's not so easy to do. For instance, suppose that you're married. can you put your marriage into a gaming metaphor? What kind of game is your marriage? Suppose you have a job, say that you have an office job in some company. Can you put your job situation into a gaming metaphor? Can you say, actually, when I go to my job, I'm not just performing these various activities and interacting with these people, but I'm actually playing a game. And the circumstances of my job, the circumstances and details and particulars of the occupation I hold, are merely the accoutrements of this game. Take the game of Monopoly. The game of Monopoly has a game board. There are positions on the board like Park Place. There are other positions on the board that indicate moves in the game like go to jail. And there are the tokens for the game that you move around the board. And then there are the cards. These are the accessories. These are the accoutrements of the game. So likewise, in any situation in life, your marriage, your family situation, your role as the citizen of a town or the citizen of a nation, your job, your creative calling in life, whatever it is, you may be a musician, work in a band or in an orchestra, you may be an artist, you may be a graphic artist. All of these activities are props and accoutrements to games, but can you name the game? This is not so easy to do. I've done it a few times in my life, and I found that the mere act of putting a situation into a gaming metaphor has a tremendous impact. It's a tremendously powerful practice. And in fact, I consider it to be one of the five highest practices of Kala Tantra. But rather than just talk about doing that, I invite you to do it with me. I invite you to enter the Mephisto game with me. We are going to treat the confrontation with evil on this planet as a game. And the name of the game is the Mephisto game, because the primary agent of evil is the Lord of Flies, Mephistopheles. So I'm not going to theorize with you, and I'm not going to spin out my elaborate Nawal-esque notions of Kalika magic simply to entertain you. I am going with you step by step into the Mephisto game. And I just want to ask you to consider this. By treating it as a game in the Kalika perspective, you're entering into an engagement that is transcendent and magical. And the proof of that will come to each of you in the same way. The proof of it will not come to each of you in different ways. It will come to each of you individuals listening to me in exactly the same way. The proof of your empowerment in Kalika magic, encountering Mephisto, comes in the same way. It's the same proof for all of us. Bear that in mind. And bear in mind as well the change of tense at the conclusion of what I just said. I began by saying the proof will come. And that's okay. That's approximative, provisional. We'll let it pass for the moment. But the correct syntax is the proof comes. This is how the proof comes. First, it comes by entering the game, by seeing the first trick of Mephisto. What is the first trick? The first trick is to see that you are invited to make a pact with the devil by a trickster who has invented the devil. It's as if someone came to you and said, You know, I represent a powerful philanthropist, a man who has a lot of money and wants to give you some. So if you just sign here, you know, sign on this line, and under certain conditions, this powerful philanthropist will deposit $10 million in your bank account. But suppose that the broker, the intermediary and representative of this philanthropist was actually the source of the funds. And he, offering you money on behalf of a philanthropist, is playing a trick because he knows that the philanthropist doesn't exist. Now that either means that he, the broker of the deal, will put the money in your account, or that there is no such money. Either way, you're being tricked. Whether Mephisto delivers you riches or not, he's tricking you as to the source of those riches. There is no deal with the devil. There is only the deal with the devil's representative, who knows himself that the devil does not exist. So there it is. You cannot enter the Mephisto game without catching Mephisto in his first trick. Now you're in the game. The game is to detect how Mephisto projects and maintains the phantoms in your mind, the phantoms of his power, which are named Satan, which are named the devil and Lucifer. Consider those three to be tricks of the trickster. They are exactly like the tricks of a stage magician. Sawing a woman in half, making something appear, making it disappear. Now you know what the adversary knows. Be close to your friends and even closer to your enemies, said the Godfather, right? Closer in perception to your enemies, not closer in intention. Now you are close to Mephisto when you know that he invites you to make a deal with an entity that he knows does not even exist, but he will convince you that it does. If you don't make the deal with him, he'll convince you in one way. If you do, he'll convince you in another way. You see the trickery? The first act of the devil is to convince you that he does not exist. When you see through that act, you step into the Mephisto game. But failure to see through that act means game over. And game is over for pretenders. I'd like to tell you exactly and precisely what I mean by those words. Some years ago, when I started MetaHistory.org in the summer of 2002. I began writing about the Gnostic theory of the Archons, the Gnostic theory of alien intrusion, as it were. And I wrote extensively about the Archons on MetaHistory.org. And I placed that term Archon in the generative context of its historical background. In other words, I spoke of the Archons in a way consistent with the Sophianic vision story. I always emphasized that the production of the Archons in the story of our solar system is a subplot within the greater story of Wisdom's Dare. That is to say, the divine experiment of the Aeon Sophia. It's a subplot, it's a factor in that story. And I developed the profile of the Archons, their origin, their motives, and their activities, in a way incomparable to anyone else. No one has come anywhere near what I've done. As MC Hammer said famously, you can't touch that. Nevertheless, in the subsequent years, since I've been writing and talking about the Archons, people around the world have picked up this term, and they've spoken in their own way about these mind parasites. Now, some of the people who speak about the Archons refer to me, have referred to me, and referred to Not in His Image and metahistory.org, and others haven't. Some people just have picked up the term Archon and used it according to their own devices or according to their own make-believe, if you will. I distinguish rigorously between anyone who talks about the Archons in reference to the Sophianic vision narrative by contrast to those who ignore or dismiss the narrative, who don't even mention it. People like Jay Widener, for instance. Jay Widener now speaks of the Archons. Recently, he did an interview on Jeff Rentz called Archons, The Archons and Sandy Hook, in which he made a number of statements about the Archons without reference to me or the Sophianic vision narrative. In fact, what Jay is doing is he's embellishing and elaborating his own personal version, his personal interpretation of who the Archons are and what they do in our reality, how they fuck with our minds. Jay Widener's version. And others as well. If you put the word Archon into a search engine, you'll find it's vastly used on the internet now without reference to the fact of who introduced it. Now, I've learned something from my experience of introducing the Archons into the discourse on this planet at the dawn of the 21st century. I've learned something about that. I want to share this lesson with you. First of all, you would understand already, I think, that I'm not beefing here about personal recognition. I really don't care if people say John Lash introduced the Gnostic profile of the Archons, an invaluable piece of intel, into the planetary discussion of what's wrong in the world today. I'm not looking for the personal recognition. I'm looking for recognition of the narrative from which that intel originates. You see, the problem with Jay Widener and people such as Jay, who cite the Archons, elaborate, expostulate on the Archons, without referring to me, is not just that they're disregarding me, but they're disregarding the Sophianic narrative. And that is a really, really big mistake. And I can assure you unequivocally that anybody talking about the Archons today who does not refer that subject back to the larger picture of the Sophianic vision story is misleading themselves and those who listen to them. Not necessarily deliberately misleading them. I wouldn't say that Jay Widener is deliberately misleading people in the way that he talks about the Archons. He's grappling with his own delusions and make-believe, and is unable to see through the smoke and mirrors of his own mind as long as he does not place the Archon discussion inside the story where it belongs. But I must add, and this is a warning to you, Jay, and anyone else who may be listening, that although you are not deliberately misleading people, you are deliberately omitting the origin of the Archon story. Not disregarding me, but disregarding the story. And to disregard the story is a very foolish, foolish thing to do. On that ground alone, you would reveal yourself as a pretender, and game is over for you even before you enter the game. Now you can go on and invent your own games, your own esoteric negotiations of make-believe. Do as you like. Fait ce que tu voudras. As Rabelais said in one of the first formulations of do what thou wilt. Do as you like. But when you do it, apart from the story of this planet, what are you doing? There's only one story to a planet. Imagine a group of people stranded on a desert island. And imagine that there have been several generations of people stranded on that island. And they live there in an island community, and they built a world for themselves. But in the course of the generations since the original event that caused them to be stranded on that island, they've forgotten that event. Now, there's only one explanation of how they got stranded on that island. A shipwreck happened. There was a ship going from a certain destination, from a certain origin, to a certain destination, with a certain cargo, with certain passengers and crew, at a certain moment in time. That ship wrecked in a storm, leaving survivors on this island. Over generations of time, the oblivion of memory left the survivors speculating about how they got on the island in the first place. And they can make up any kind of story they want about how they got on the island. But in fact, there can only be one explanation. Likewise, there is only one explanation of what's happening on this planet. And you find that explanation in the biography of the planet itself. Isn't that obvious? How can I make it any more obvious? And I have not invented the biography of this planet. I retrieved it from the remains of Gnostic teachings. Anyone who uses their imagination without engaging the biography of this planet is delusional and can offer nothing but delusional embellishments, and usually for a price, whether that be the price of their personal fame, their prestige, the prestige to be known as a dazzling intellectual magician who can talk about all kinds of esoteric matters and symbolic and mythological correspondences and even reveal the ultimate secrets of alchemy, such as, for instance, that the philosopher's stone is piss. This is where you end up when you dissociate yourself, not from John Lash, who introduced the Archons to the internet, but from the story he drew upon to do so. So I learned a lot from what resulted of my introducing the Archons in that way. I didn't make any mistake. I took a calculated risk. And the consequences of that risk can be found today, can be seen in the dialogue and discourse that comes from such animals as Jay Widener. So the moment comes, this Sunday morning, January 27, 2013, when I can say, with confidence, and really with no animosity whatsoever, that Jay Widener and anyone else who uses the Archon syntax without reference to the Sophianic vision narrative is a pretender. In what sense is he and those others, in what sense are they pretending? Well, they're pretending to stand there and tell the world something insightful and helpful about the workings of archontic delusion and the enmeshment of humanity in evil behavior due to the delusional tactics of those mind parasites. They're pretending to teach you something about evil that would be helpful in facing evil and overcoming it. And I am here to tell you that they are doing nothing of the sort. That they are only pretending to tell you about evil because in fact they have not engaged the Mephisto game. Evil presents itself in a game, and the game is over for Jay Widener and others in the opening move. The game is over in the opening move. I don't just claim that. I intend to prove that to be so. I offer you this proof to unfold from this day on. John Lash introduced the term archons to the internet quite a few years ago. And in 2013, he introduces the term Mephisto. Now, over the course of those 10 or so years, many people have taken up the word archon and used it, sometimes with reference, rarely, but sometimes with reference to its origin in the sacred narrative of the mysteries. Usually not. Now, let's watch what happens from this moment on regarding who may use the term Mephisto. Who may use the term Mephisto? This is a different game now. This is a different game. Because anyone who picks up this term introduced by me will demonstrate in the manner that they use it whether they are a pretender or a voracious investigator of evil. The term itself is the test. The term itself, the name of the trickster, is the first test in this game. And I defy anyone listening to these words now or in the future to use that term. I defy them to use it without it coming back to me. You see, I could let the Archon intel go out generously and without attachment to consequences. I did that because it happened to be my mission to recover and restore the Sophianic vision story, and the Archons are part of the story. I didn't make up the story. The Gnostics had that story as the centerpiece of their teaching. But using the term Mephisto from this moment on is not anything like using the term Archon. Those of you who move with me now through this portal know that the Trinity of Evil includes the Archons with Mephisto and Melchizedek. That Trinity is like a set of sights mounted on your mind. Using the Matangi eye, you look through those sights at the source of evil in this world. The source of evil is lies. In fact, evil itself is a lie. Ultimately, there is no such thing as evil. Evil is a lie. But that's a lie that becomes real in human behavior. The power of the lie cannot be denied. And on that note, let me read you another line from Goethe's Faust. Here I'm looking
at yet another translation. This would be the translation by the great humanist philosopher whom I admire hugely and from whom I learned a great deal, Walter Kaufmann. Walter Kaufmann. And there is an edition of part one and sections from part two published by Anchor Books, which has the German on the left and the English translation on the right. This is from Kaufmann's translation of that moment of the first encounter of Faust and Mephistopheles. You remember that after Mephisto says, "I am part of a power that would alone work evil, but engenders good," Faust presents to him the great question. This is the entrance question, the question that you and I and everyone must ask to engage in the Mephisto game. "Faust, what is it that this puzzle indicates?" And here is the answer of Mephisto. "I am the spirit that denies, and rightly so, for all that comes to be deserves to perish wretchedly. 'Twere better nothing would begin, thus everything that your terms, sin, destruction, evil represent, that is my proper element." End quote. You can read and read and reread this passage, and it is absolutely brilliant in what it reveals of the workings of the trickster. The trickster himself tells you the truth, because sometimes Mephisto does speak the truth. You know how it is with any disinformation agent. They have to tell you the truth so that they can slip in the lies, don't they? And so when Mephisto says, "I am the spirit that denies, and rightly so, for all that comes to be deserves to perish wretchedly," this is the envy and contempt of the tulpa Mephisto for the human imagination that he has hijacked. And when he says, "I am the spirit that denies," he warns humanity of the denial in our own minds, the denial of the anthropos, the denial of the human animal. I've said recently that the naivete and denial of the human animal reach a dimension that is positively staggering. And this is the greatest handicap of the anthropos. And it is uniquely our responsibility to face this double handicap of naivete and denial. In the last briefing, I cited the article called The 9/11 Solution, From Deception to Liberation, that I published on MetaHistory.org 2 years ago. And at the opening of that article, I wrote this line: "It has been said that the main obstacle to accepting what happened on 9/11 is the refusal to believe that anyone could be so evil." End quote. That refusal to believe that anyone could be so evil is the naivete of the anthropos, of the human animal. And you combine that naivete, that false, unfounded belief in human goodness, by contrast to the true engagement in human goodness. They're not the same. That naivete, along with our capacity for denial, is precisely what gives Mephisto his power. And he says so right there in those lines. "I am the spirit that denies, for all that has come to be deserves to perish wretchedly." This is his motive. This is his game. He only plays the game in order to see us ruin ourselves in the game and to perish wretchedly. That is the pleasure of Mephisto, as it is the pleasure of the archons. You find in the Apocryphon of John that long and complex Gnostic text that I've cited recently, the most explicit designation
that the pleasure of the archons is deception. Apaton, deception. And you can believe that this living tulpa who hangs around in the collective unconscious of humanity, like the tulpa of Alexandra David Neal, is a jokester and a comedian as well, and really enjoys watching humanity lose its mind by playing his game. And those who claim to be exposing the workings of evil on this planet and of deception, such as Jay Widener and others, who do not speak of the trinity of evil in the way that I do, are accessories to that game, and they're pretenders. But they're not even really in the game. It's game over for pretenders who cannot even answer the first riddle of Mephisto. How can you make a deal with a broker who represents Satan when Satan is just an invention of the broker? How can you make such a deal? So in concluding this briefing, let me be lucidly clear about the challenge I am now putting out. Now, I'm putting out a challenge to the world. Initially, I put it out in oral form, spoken in these NAB briefings. Soon enough, the challenge goes out in written form. When the challenge is in written form, the word Mephisto will appear, and anyone who goes into a search engine looking for Mephisto will eventually come across the reference to these talks, the Trinity of Evil, the Identity of the Adversary or Trickster. And from that moment on, anyone who chooses to use this term, as people chose to pick up the term Archon, anyone who uses it cannot do so without revealing themselves as a pretender or not. That ought to clear the decks very nicely, don't you think? It's a great moment for the Nahual coming out of the stall of the lunar apogee, coming toward the direct movement of Jupiter near the Eye of the Bull in January 2013. It's a great moment because not only can I teach, can I advance the teaching of the Sophianic vision story to another level, but I can demonstrate the performance of Kala Tantrika magic right in front of your eyes. Years back, at some dinner party that I attended in 2008, I described Gayan Tantra as the sorcery of love and intention. The sorcery I now perform is based on love and intention. The love is not for humanity. It's not for the herd of human animals living today. It's not for the human race. It's not for human society. No. The love that motivates me is for truth. Truth. And the beauty of truth. That is what motivates me. The war on this planet is not between light and dark. Scrap that syntax. It's hideously misleading. The war is between truth and lies. And evil plays its game between truth and lies. The act of sorcery of Kalika magic that I now initiate comes from the love of truth that lives in you as much as in me, and it propagates on a single and exact intention. That intention is to dissolve by one master stroke the entire aggregation of smoke and mirrors that impede detection of the true face of evil. That is the intention of my introduction of the term Mephisto to the internet, both orally and in written form. That term is a test. The introduction of the words archons was not a test. It was an invitation. It was something like a sounding device. But the introduction of Mephisto, count on this, is a test. And I dare anyone to use this term. I invite you to use this term. Go ahead and see where it gets you. You think you can really observe the operations of deceit and evil on this planet? Well, I would ask you correspondingly, if you can see what evil and the deceptive powers are doing, can you see with equal clarity the actions of the sorcerer who defeats those powers? Can you see what I'm doing? Do you want to see what I'm doing? Then you must look into perfect transparency from your own transparency. In every single act of Kalika warfare I now undertake, I employ the weapon of transparency. Pretenders cannot hide from Mephisto. Mephisto hides out in the open. Mephisto is right out in the open. I've said in the commentaries on Gnostic sabotage in the Book of Revelation, demons of the human mind flee darkness. Those demons of deceit and delusion and self-delusion thrive in the open light of day. They hide out in the open. They are revealed in the darkness. The power that shines through my mind is a ray of transparency that comes out of darkness. And that transparency is so brilliant that it is even more revealing than the light into which it shines. But pretenders who pretend to reveal the evil and deception operating on this planet do not have that transparency. For one thing, they don't tell you what their agenda is. I don't have any idea what Jay Widener's agenda is. I don't have a clue. Nor do I know what the agenda of David Icke is. He's never said. The difference between John Lash and other individuals is that John Lash tells you up front, square and even, transparently, what is his agenda. You know what I follow in my vision of life. You know the practices that I do. And that's all there is to it. There's nothing else there. I'm not selling anything, and I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything. Now I invite you to find your position relative to the challenge of the Mephisto game. And I invite you also, if you position yourself in the same way as I do regarding the trickster, if you choose to do that, I invite you to send this challenge out into the world along with me. Those of you in Planetary Tantra and in the GNE need to know this. You need to remind yourself of this and be mindful every day now that by introducing this term Mephisto into the world, I am performing an actual act of Kalika magic by use of the word. You notice that when he introduces himself to Faust, Mephisto refers playfully to the power of the word and the use of the word, and even says to Faust, speaking in an ironic and comical and taunting manner, Mephisto says, "Oh, why do you want to know my name? You're a man who doesn't put a lot of faith in words, and you want to get to this, to the truth of things behind words, to the reality, so why should you even know? Why should you even care what my name is?" You see, this is in the game. This is in the fuming, sulfurous atmosphere of the game. The play on words, the double speak, the duplicitous language. And against that, the brilliance of Gnostic syntax. So I invite you to use the word Mephisto in forums. If you have internet platforms like a website or a blog, put the word Mephisto into written form on the internet. But I ask you in doing so that you define it according to the terms I have defined it in the Trinity of Evil, and that you refer to me as the originator of this definition. And by extension, you refer through me to the Sophianic narrative. Heed the words of Mephisto. I am the spirit that denies. Mephisto is not the source of the tendency to denial in the human animal, but Mephisto hypes and amplifies that source to a demonic level where it becomes destructive. So be clear, I don't need anybody's recognition, but anyone who investigates the problem of evil on this planet today needs to recognize the Sophianic vision story as a solution to the problem. I talk solution. I demonstrate solution. I enact solution. And the problem with anyone who uses the term Archon without referring to me is a problem of denial, isn't it? Can you see that? The omission of reference to the origin of that term in Gnostic teachings is an act of denial against the goddess. Denial against the goddess. And the only reason why this act of denial against the goddess can continue without being detected for what it is because of that massive construction of smoke and mirrors that I hereby dissolve in one master stroke. So the game is on, the Mephisto game. But the game is over for pretenders at the first move. And from this moment on, you who heed my words can observe how the pretenders fall away. And you may feel, as I do already, a dawning sense of relief. And you may breathe a huge sigh of relief to see that the end of the self-important posturing of these clowns is finally at hand.